Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, with Donald Trump suggesting a possible, quote, major conflict, end quote, with North Korea over its nuclear weapons program, we revisit the politics of North Korea. But first, what are the political implications of Brexit? Last month, Oxford University professor Paul Craig gave a seminar on the subject, exploring what Brexit could mean, both for the United Kingdom and beyond.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Paul Craig, the Professor of English Law at the University of Oxford. He's an expert on constitutional and administrative law in the UK. He's written extensively on EU law. He's been an interpreter of EU law for a British public. And he's recently been an expert witness at the UK House of Lords Constitutional Committee on the Great Repeal Bill, of which we'll be hearing more. So without further ado, I welcome Professor Paul Craig.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much indeed. What I thought would be helpful, because there are a huge number of legal, constitutional and political issues concerning Brexit, what would be helpful, I thought, now would be if I gave some sort of roadmap through Article 50 and through the different stages of Brexit, and looking at the constitutional and legal issues and the political backdrop to them, because that seemed to me at least a way into this minefield of different legal and constitutional issues. So that's what I'm going to do, but as I said, I'm very happy to take questions more broadly on any aspect of this. So, Article 50 was a new article in the Lisbon Treaty. There was not an escape clause or withdrawal clause beforehand. There was debate about whether a state could withdraw. The best version or the best view about that was that it was, or was that a state could leave, and that the rules about withdrawal would probably be drawn from the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, given that this was or is the master plan for treaty interpretation. But that was no longer needed because in the pretty much everything in the Lisbon Treaty is actually taken from the Constitutional Treaty of 2004. The Constitutional Treaty never became reality because of the negative votes in referenda in France and Holland. But pretty much everything new in the Lisbon Treaty is carried over from the Constitutional Treaty, including Article 50, or the substance of Article 50. Article 50 was first written, and the idea was not that it would be used by a state such as the UK. It was the best view from Sir John Kerr and Giuliano Amato, two of the leading lights in the constitutional who framed the constitutional treaty. The idea behind Article 50 was that actually it was going to be a way of kicking out a recalcitrant state. The real idea was that if a state started going absent without leave and started becoming too autocratic, then in effect what would happen is that Article 50 would be the way to push it out the door rather than the state actually seeking to leave. No one actually thought at the time that the state would seriously wish to leave. Okay, so that much just by way of background. So, Article 50, what are the different stages in constitutional and legal terms? Well, stage one has already happened. Stage one is that it's for the state in question to trigger Article 50 in accordance with the constitutional requirements of that state. And that is exactly what has happened in the UK. The Prime Minister triggered Article 50 on the 29th of March, having, however, had a long fight in the courts about exactly what the constitutional requirements of the United Kingdom were in this respect. The judgment ended up being given, first of all, by the Divisional Court in the Miller litigation, and then it went straight from the Divisional Court to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held by 8-3, one powerful dissent by Lord Reed in particular, but it held by 8-3 that the executive could not trigger withdrawal from or under Article 50, that in accordance with the constitutional requirements of the United Kingdom, the triggering required parliamentary approval for a statute. It could not be undertaken by and through the prerogative. There was lots of controversial argument, or lots of contestable arguments put about this. The case rapidly became the most blogged about case in English legal history, and that is a record which will not easily be broken. It made history as well by being the first instance, or the first case, where 4 days of Supreme Court coverage was streamed continuously, knocking Coronation Street off its previous ascendancy in the TV ratings. And the judgment was given, as I said, it was 8-3. That was pretty widely predicted. Everyone, in fact, had predicted it was going to be 7-4 rather than 8-3. People then wondered about, well, who switched sides at the last moment, and that's not clear. My own view is, in fact, a rather heterodox view, but I think almost certainly true, which is that the Russian hackers tried on the US election and then were messing up the French election with Fillon, and in between have revealed the denouement of Sherlock Holmes. So they were really pretty busy, and they could only get their B team onto the hacking of the result in Miller in the Supreme Court, and therefore they got it won out. You know, 7-4, 8-3, hey, it's not a big deal. That's in effect what happened. Now, lots and lots of argumentation amongst constitutional scholars about whether the decision was right or wrong. There are two views about this, the right view and the wrong view. The right view is that the Supreme Court got it right. By the majority, the wrong view is that they got it wrong. I think that they did get it right. I don't think that the issues were straightforward, but on a serious note, I think that they did get it right. And I actually do think that they not only got it right analytically, I think it actually, the decision coheres with one's intuition about constitutional argumentation and result in the following sense. If you think about it, stand back from it, this was withdrawal from the EU, whether you are a Remainer or a Brexiteer, is the most important single decision of a peacetime nature concerning a treaty which has ever been made by the UK. Now, actually, if you stand back and think about it in that way, the very idea that the executive should be able to do this autonomously without securing approval from Parliament is actually quite extraordinary. I mean, it's quite extraordinary that anyone could imagine that that would be or should be the right result. In normative terms, it beggars belief. Actually, but that's not the reason why I think they got it right. I think they got it right because I think that the unorthodox constitutional reasoning, the classic limits on the prerogative applied, and the classic limits derived from the case of proclamations and de Keyser applied, with the consequence that the executive could not rely on the prerogative in this particular case, and they have to have recourse to Parliament. Final word on Miller, just by way of footnote, but interesting political footnote, because everything in this whole area is an admixture of the legal and the political. I mean, just everything. So the real, one of the interesting political questions with a small and a large P is why the case was ever fought. And the answer to that is simply not obvious. The Prime Minister didn't have to fight this case. She didn't. She could, in October or November, have gone to the House of Commons and simply said, I do not accept as a matter of legal principle that I have to seek your authorization before triggering Article 50. I do not concede that point, but I'm going to seek it anyway. So she didn't have to, she wouldn't have to fight it legally. Her legal advisors could not possibly have given her any more, any better than odds of 50-50 winning, and that would be putting it high. So she could, she didn't have to fight this case. Could have saved the taxpayer a lot of money. And of course, once you put things in the hands of the court, you never know what the outcome's going to be because you're putting it in the hands of the court. And as happened when Parliament did consider the matter in late February, early March, she could have produced in November exactly the kind of bill that she produced in early March, a two-line bill with precisely 164 words, if you really are going to be pedantic about it. And that's all she produced, and that secured passage through both Houses of Parliament and received royal assent without a single amendment being forced against the government. She could have secured exactly the same outcome in November. So one of the interesting things historically is when the 30-year rule has passed, whether we find documentation indicating as to why actually she did bother to fight. Anyway, that's all stage one, and that's happened. So it's triggered. So what happens now? What are the legal political issues which happen next? Well, the legal political issues which happen next are exactly the things going on now. Under Article 50, the next stage is that the European Council puts together guidelines for the Brexit negotiations. The European Council is the body within the European Union which consists of the heads of state, the heads of government, the presidents, prime ministers of the 28 member states. It has a permanent or semi-permanent president, President Tusk from Poland, who's now in his second term. The way it works is that President Tusk has put together the guidelines or draft of the guidelines. You can't draft in the committee of 27, 28. So Tusk put together a draft of the guidelines, presenting it to the other 27, to the 27 member states, saying, here is what I think the guidelines for the negotiation should be. Once those guidelines are agreed, the actual negotiations are undertaken by the Commission, and the Commission, the person representing the Commission is a very seasoned, very professional and very clever man from France, Michel Barnier. He is going to be a tough negotiator. He's not going to give an inch or anything else, as it were, to the British in that respect. Now, the position of the other European institution, or one of the other European institutions, is important as well. The European Parliament has no formal position or role in the Brexit negotiations. There's no formal position, no formal role in the Brexit negotiations. But it does have voice in the following sense. Any withdrawal agreement which is made, and I'll say more about the nature of the withdrawal agreement in a moment, any withdrawal agreement which is made has to obtain the approval of the European Parliament. So the European Parliament's views are going to matter. And only today, the European Parliament put forward its guidelines. Okay, so the European Parliament has survived and prospered by doing what parliaments have done in every country in the world, which is taking the power they've got and used it as a ratchet to get more or to maximise their input. So they know they have no voice in the actual negotiations, But they're putting on the table, these are our guidelines, and therefore they're sending a signal to the other political branches of government to say, be careful, make sure that you do not end up with an agreement which transgresses the guidelines which we are putting down, because if you do, you do so at your peril. They have a veto, all right? If they don't approve it, if they don't approve a withdrawal agreement, that's it. Subject to political arm twisting and all that sort of stuff later. Okay, so that's what's happening now. So what are the legal modalities? So stage three, what are the legal modalities moving forward? Well, what Article 50 provides for is at least two agreements, perhaps three, but it provides for at least two agreements. There is a withdrawal agreement, and that's the main game in town under Article 50, the divorce. Okay? Article 50 is also framed in terms not only of a withdrawal agreement, but Article 50 speaks in terms of the idea that while you're negotiating the withdrawal agreement, there may also be discourse about future trade relations between the UK and the EU. Now, so this is stage three of our game, as it were, or stage three of the process. Now, just to make it absolutely clear, there's the, to make clear the nature of these two agreements. So you have the withdrawal agreement and the future trade relations agreement. Now, I think what's very important to emphasize is that the respective content of these agreements is not fixed in stone. You could have a fat divorce, a withdrawal agreement which was really quite meaty and contained an awful lot, with the consequence that the agreement concerning future trade relations was actually relatively thin by way of comparison. You could alternatively have a scenario where the divorce agreement, the withdrawal agreement, is relatively thin and an awful lot is left for resolution in the future trade relationship. What's the key criterion which determines the fatness and relative fatness and thinness of the two agreements? It's this. If the UK had gone for what is known in the jargon of the trade as a soft Brexit solution, if it had gone for a soft Brexit solution, other things being equal, a strong likelihood that the withdrawal agreement would be quite fat and the future trade relationship agreement would be quite thin. Why? On the soft Brexit option, the soft Brexit option is predicated on the idea that the state in question models itself rather on the model of Norway and the other states which are part of the European Economic Area. And states which belong to the EEA get full access to the single market and the customs union pretty much. But the quid pro quo is that they have to accept the full rigors of the four freedoms, including free movement of people. Hard Brexiteers have never been willing to accept that. But just still sticking to the fatness and thinness of the two agreements, if the UK had gone down the soft Brexit solution, if they had, then the withdrawal agreement would almost certainly be modelled directly on the EEA agreement, of which there is a detailed boilerplate there. It's a long treaty which already exists. You would take that, you would cut and paste it, you would put it into your withdrawal agreement, and that would, there wouldn't be very much left to be dealt with by a future trade agreement. However, the UK has not gone down the soft Brexit solution. The UK has gone down the road of hard Brexit. A hard Brexit meaning that the government is saying, no, we're not seeking access to the single market and probably not the customs union either, because that will only come with the price tag of free movement, which the hard Brexiteers within the Tory party are not willing to accept. What that means in terms of the relative content of the withdrawal agreement and the future trade relations agreement is this. It is very likely that the withdrawal agreement will be quite thin. It will be a quickie divorce, but it will not be simple or easy. Quickie in the sense that the content put into the withdrawal agreement is going to be relatively small. What will it contain? It will contain the financial settlement. At the moment, there is a wide gap between the two sides. The bill for Britain's exit is somewhere between 28 and 60 billion, more than I earn in a week. There's going to be very hard negotiation about that sum. But also, in that divorce, there's other big issues. The rights of EU citizens in the UK and UK citizens in Europe will become part of the divorce settlement. So too will important institutional issues. The European Banking Authority and the EMA, the European Medicines Authority, are both situated in London. They're going to be moved. They're going to be pulled out. And that's going to have important consequences of various kinds as well. That will probably all be included in the withdrawal agreement. It probably won't contain much else, but I doubt whether it'll end up containing much else, which is why the PM, our PM's bargaining position is, the UK wants negotiation about withdrawal and negotiation about the future trade agreement to happen in parallel. Okay? They know that the content of the divorce is going to be relatively thin, that agreement. They know the real game in town in terms of future trade relations and safeguarding the position of the city and all that and preventing a meltdown of the UK economy is going to happen because of the content of the trade agreement, which is why they want the two to go in parallel. So we have not only a substantive issue, which is what's the content of the respective agreements, there's also a process issue, which gets discussed first. Now, as I've just mentioned, the UK's bargaining position is we want both of them discussed in parallel. It is not fortuitous that one of the very headline issues that came out from TUS in the guidelines for the European Council and that came out from the European Parliament in their bargaining guidelines is, in technical legal terms, no way. No way. They said the formulation varied, but in technically, the substance was there is no way we're having parallel talks going through at the same time. We're going to have significant progress on the divorce stricto sensu before we even begin to pick up any issues concerning the future trade relationship. Okay? Now just, I know limits of time, but just a word more about this issue, this stage three. Why is this all so important? It's so important because if an awful lot has to be done by an FTA, a free trade agreement of some kind, then one has to be mindful of the logistics, in every sense of the term, of negotiating FTAs. Now, this all may be known to everyone, but in case it's not, let me just put a few kind of basics on the table here. The average FTA is not a livre de poche. It's not a book at bedtime, and it weighs in at a chubby 260 odd pages. That is actually quite small compared to some of the FTAs. The FTA between Canada and the EU weighed in at about 1600 pages. All right? Not rocket science to understand that the longer the FTA, its length is commensurate with how ambitious it is. The core of a free trade agreement is about tariffs. It's usually mainly about goods, and it's about tariffs and customs duties and equivalent conditions for trade. The more ambitious you want your trade agreement to be, if you want it to cover services, if you want it to cover IP, if you want it to cover competition, then it gets bigger and fatter, and it takes longer to negotiate. Average FTAs the average FTA takes somewhere between 4 and 6 years to negotiate. Okay, and there's and that's leaving aside, as it were, political goodwill or badwill, as the case may be in this instance. What that all means is that there's a strong likelihood that at the end of the two-year period, and Article 50 has a two-year deadline in it, by which time a withdrawal agreement has to be made, or certain consequences follow, about which I'll say one word in a moment. But basically, what that all means is the following. What that all means is I have 1 minute left. So what that means is that almost certainly there'll have to be a third agreement called a transitional agreement. Now, everything about the nature of a transitional agreement is uncertain. Just about everything. Its legal provenance is uncertain, its legal nature is uncertain, and its legal content is uncertain. Except everyone's beginning to turn the knife. Everyone's beginning to turn the knife in a nice, delicate way. So the Parliament is beginning to turn the knife by saying, if you have a transitional agreement to ease the passage between withdrawal and a future trade agreement, then of course the European Court of Justice will have to have full authority over the terms of it, which is enough to cause political apoplexy amongst the backbenches of the Tory party. 30 seconds, stage four. Stage four, part four, and then I stop. Stage four, there is a two-year deadline. If no agreement is reached within 2 years, then what Article 50 states is that unless all the member states of the European Council agree to an extension of time, we, the UK, fall off the edge of the cliff. That is, rights and obligations under EU law cease to apply at the end of that two-year period, which means that in legal terms you default to the WTO default position, which would almost certainly be very harmful to the UK economy. But there is a reasonable likelihood that we could end up in a situation where no agreement is reached and where we do indeed fall off the edge of the cliff. Thank you very much indeed.
When we come back, making sense of the politics of North Korea. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're revisiting the politics of North Korea with this panel that originally aired in April 2013. Tensions have once again escalated between North Korea and the U.S. What are the realities of the politics of North Korea? And what is the proper response of the United States and the international community? Stephen Haggard is with us. He is professor at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. He's also the co-author of Famine in North Korea and Witness to Transformation, Refugee Insights into North Korea. He also co-edits a blog about North Korea. Jacques Hymans also joins us. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of The Psychology of Nuclear Proliferation, Identity, Emotions, and Foreign Policy, and Achieving Nuclear Ambitions, Scientists, Politicians, and Proliferation. Charles Armstrong is also with us. He is professor of Korean studies and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy in the State, and the forthcoming Tyranny of the Week, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with a historical context for the current state of affairs with North Korea. Charles Armstrong, let's start with you. What do you think we need to know about the past to understand the current situation?
Well, I think the most important thing to know is that we've been, in a sense, in a state of war with North Korea for 63 years. The Korean War, which went from 1950 to 53, ended in an armistice, and Kim Jong-un has been good enough to remind us of the armistice by saying that it was nullified, which means there was never a peace treaty, there was never a formal end to the war. So that's one context, 60 years of this confrontation between the U.S. and North Korea. The other thing to remember is that this sort of belligerence and bluster from North Korea is a recurrent theme and especially reaches peaks during the U.S.-South Korean joint military exercises, going back to 1976, the first so-called Team Spirit exercise. And this is another reason that North Korea has really ratcheted up the rhetoric, although it has to be said, I don't think any of us have seen the rhetoric ratcheted up quite this high yet. And the third thing to remember is that we've had a confrontation with North Korea specifically over their nuclear weapons program for almost 20 years, since 1994, when we came very close to what appears to be have been a serious military confrontation and a contemplation of a preemptive strike on North Korea's nuclear facilities. So what's happened now is those things have come together, and the sanctions that the UN has put on North Korea after the nuclear test. And finally, we have a leader in North Korea who seems to really want to show us and his own people that he means business and he can talk tougher than any of his predecessors.
Well, we're going to want to talk about each of those things a little bit more in depth. Stephen Haggard, let's bring you in now. What else do you think we really need to know about the history of this relationship, the history of North Korea, South Korea, that really will help us to make sense of all this?
Let me just endorse the things that Charles has said. I think the background of the unsettled war, the fact that we only have an armistice, this is a particularly important background condition because one of the questions looking forward is how we might resolve that state of war, whether it's possible to get back to negotiations, and I think that's something which is hanging over all of the escalatory rhetoric. The two other things I would add have to do with a little bit more of the recent history. The onset of the current nuclear crisis is around the fall of 2002. So we've had about a decade when we've had a kind of heightened tension over North Korea's nuclear ambitions. And that's resulted in a succession of nuclear tests, one in 2006, another in 2009, and most recently. And in the wake of each of those, the United States has been able to orchestrate a set of UN Security Council resolutions imposing various sanctions on North Korea. And China has been a key player in those negotiations because the Security Council allows any of the P5 countries to veto such resolutions, which means basically we have to negotiate something that the Chinese can live with. And we've seen a bit of a stepping up of pressure on the part of China. I mean, they're still not willing to really use the full leverage they have over North Korea, but they seem to be willing to impose somewhat more costs on North Korea than they have in the past.
Jacques Hymans.
I think it might be interesting for your listeners to hear a little bit about the world context of nuclear proliferation over the decades and how North Korea fits into that. I also endorse what my previous two colleagues have said. On the world stage, North Korea actually started working on nuclear weapons, we believe, all the way back in the 1960s. the evidence coming out of Eastern European archives after the end of the Cold War. Those Eastern European states had good relations with North Korea, and so they were able to get a little bit more of an inside view than most Western states could have. And the North Koreans were pretty explicit already back in the 1960s that they were trying to build nuclear weapons. So they've been pretty constantly at this work for a half century now. And yet the world sort of has moved on. In the 60s, it wasn't all that uncommon for states to be trying to launch nuclear weapons programs. But over time, thanks in part to changes in the way that states think about themselves and think about power in the world, and thanks in part to particular nonproliferation measures such as the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which came into force in 1970, essentially states have moved away from seeking nuclear weapons as a prime element of their international security postures. And so today, really, we only have two states that are even widely suspected of seeking nuclear weapons. They don't have them already, one being North Korea and the other being Iran. And even in the case of Iran, there's a lot of question marks about their ultimate intentions. So North Korea is really sticking out like a sore thumb in the international context today in terms of its pursuit of nuclear weapons.
You bring up another aspect of this, which is they're sticking out like a sore thumb. Everybody else is starting to phase out their nuclear weapons. What does it mean with this leader pursuing nuclear weapons? Some people have called him crazy. Stefan Haggard, you've mentioned that you don't think he's crazy. What about the psychology of the new leader? What do we know of him?
Well, we don't know that much, really. First of all, he's young, so that's an interesting thing to take into account. He's 28 years old or so. He was schooled in Switzerland. We're not sure that really makes any difference. But you have to look at a system like this not in terms of just the personalities, though those can be important, but in terms of a kind of coalition of political actors that are running a regime of this sort. This is clearly a very closed system. I think your listeners all know that it has one of the worst records with respect to human rights and civil liberties. It's obviously an autocracy, but it's particularly narrow in its composition. And the military has come to play a very central role in both the support for the top family leadership and also in the legitimation strategy of the regime. In the 90s, Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father, had to assume power following the death of his father in 1994, and he didn't have military credentials and very quickly turned to the military to get himself through an extremely difficult period, including a famine that killed somewhere between 600,000 and a million North Koreans. So the military is very deeply implicated in the political structure of North Korea, and I think that's influencing some of what we're seeing today as well.
Charles Armstrong here. I agree with Steph's analysis of this. But North Korea has put a lot of investment, both political and, of course, economic, into the development of nuclear weapons, in part because they don't have much else. They have a very weak economy, one of the poorest countries in the world. They've had great many difficulties over the last couple of decades, and yet they've insisted that they will be a powerful and prosperous nation. And so increasingly over time, they have, it seems, made the choice that nuclear weapons are the way to go. They are a relatively economical defense. They see this as a deterrence against a hostile United States. And over the last 20 years of the confrontation between the U.S. and the other members of the international community and North Korea over the North's nuclear weapons program, it's become more and more evident, and until now it's become completely out of the open, that North Korea is not intending to give up its nuclear weapons. They've said that a number of times explicitly, and that puts us in a real dilemma because clearly the U.S. and other countries do not find that acceptable. I want to add one more thing. South Korea also had a very vigorous nuclear weapons development program in the 1970s. It was finally put to a stop under intense pressure from the United States, but this is also something that North Korea has been, in a way, reacting to. And one of the more interesting polls taken in South Korea, actually two separate polls gave the same result. The majority, perhaps as many as two-thirds of South Koreans, are now saying they should have their own nuclear deterrent. So the danger we face is not just North Korea having nuclear weapons, but the possibility of other countries in the region wanting to develop a nuclear deterrent or a nuclear arsenal as well.
This Scholar Circle panel on the politics of North Korea originally aired in April 2013. Jacques Hyman, you've pointed out that North Korea has been failing at its efforts of building nuclear weapons, but you also say that it has not merely been acting out. Do you agree with your colleagues on this?
I agree in part with my colleagues, and perhaps I would place a little bit of a different emphasis on some factors than in their comments here. First of all, in terms of who is actually driving this program forward, I obviously do not know the internal politics of inside the regime, how strong Kim Jong-un may have been, you know, immediately upon receiving the crown. But my impression of the North Korean regime is that the family leadership that Steph mentioned really is at the very pinnacle here. And we should not view the military as some sort of alternative structure to the civilian political leaders. The civilian leaders definitely control the military. They are able to replace top military leaders seemingly at will. Kim Jong-un has replaced some top leaders. So I don't think it's entirely right to portray this as a kind of a tug of war. The family is in charge, and as Steph very rightly says, it's a very, very small group of people who are intensely committed to retaining their control. So I do think that if not Kim Jong-un as an individual, certainly a very small group of individuals are making decisions about this. And this has important consequences because in sort of modern states, people at the top are able to take advantage of a large amount of thinking and planning and legwork that is being done for them by professionals who are working for the state. But in North Korea, the people underneath the guys at the top are really afraid of the guys at the top and not able to apply kind of professional training to writing the course of policy and putting it in a direction that would be, let's say, sensible. So in a sense, I do endorse to some extent the sort of journalistic talk about the North Korean regime is crazy, not in the sense that the top family members that are running the state are clinically insane, but rather in the sense that the information that they are dealing with is certainly far inferior to the information that is at the fingertips of most other modern state leaders.
You're saying if they had that professional guidance, that perhaps it wouldn't be escalating quite like this.
It's much more possible that in this situation of tension and crisis that there is miscalculation around the corner, which might be lower possibility in the event that these people had better professional advice around them. I might also add, just on the issue of the North Korean desire for nuclear weapons, that at least in my research, I have found that that desire has actually been quite constant over the years, and I would not place a lot of stress on this or that external carrot or stick that might have been proffered to North Korea. This has really been a core element of North Korean international identity, really, very long before the end of the Cold War, for instance. And I don't think that we would expect at this stage, or even 10 years ago, that this or that carrot or stick would have, you know, caused them to deviate fundamentally from their path. Of course, carrots and sticks could and were used to decrease tensions at some point or increase tensions, but in terms of causing them to deviate from their strategic objective of having a nuclear weapons arsenal, basically, I think that that was not possible already from the start.
Charles Armstrong?
I'm not sure I agree with that. First of all, they did freeze their plutonium program for 8 years after the agreed framework of October of 1994. So it may be the case that nuclear weapons acquisition has been an important part of their strategy, but it's also a matter of degree. And maybe they could not be cajoled or incentivized to eliminate their nuclear arsenal altogether, but I think there have been means that have sometimes been reasonably successful to get them to at least freeze or slow down their program. And
sorry, just Jacques, kind of quickly, I don't want to say that I disagree with that. I want to endorse that. As I mentioned, carrots and sticks have been used in the past to decrease tensions.
Right, but what I'm saying is that the way they talk to the world about their nuclear weapons now is different from the past. They actually threatened the U.S. with a nuclear strike, which I don't think we need to take seriously, but they really have made it much more a central part of their posture against the outside world.
Is there a benefit to North Korea to keep the tensions heightened like this? Is there a domestic benefit to this? Charles Armstrong, you had written a bit about this. Do you think that's the case?
Yes, and I think Steph Haggard would have a few things to say about this as well. But very briefly, it is important to keep tensions at a certain level, to keep the society mobilized, and to keep the focus on the leadership. So I think there is a domestic element to this, but I'm not sure that the North Korean leadership wants to push things this far because on a regular basis, because it is a huge drain on them economically to mobilize their military, to move missiles around, and so on. So yes, I think there is a sense in which the leadership needs an enemy to keep the country's focus and to mobilize the citizens behind the leader. And this has been the case for over 60 years.
I often wonder if that's the case in most political leaderships. Stephen Haggard, I think you've been prompted to come in on this.
Okay. Let me go back to something that Jacques said. And again, partly sharpening differences where they may be not quite as sharp as I'm making them. But Jacques is right that the top leadership purged elements of the military following the transition to Kim Jong-un. And if you look back before the death of Kim Jong-il in December of 2011, there was clearly an attempt on Kim Jong-un's father's part to put in place a set of military and civilian party and family leaders who could support the transition. And what we saw is that after Kim Jong-un came to power, he did in fact purge some of those military leaders, but at the same time he promoted his own military people into positions of authority. And we see that bodies like the Politburo, the National Defense Commission, even the Secretariat, which is an administrative apparatus of the party, see this big influx of military personnel. So I do think this still has to be understood as a regime in which the military plays a role, not so much a decision-making role, but it's a component of the key coalition or core coalition of the state. But the other thing is that the military has become a kind of symbol, a trope almost, for the whole country. And when the father, Kim Jong-il, came to office, he launched a political line, I think you would call it, which is military-first politics. And the meaning of military-first politics is very complicated, but one component of it is that the whole society should see itself as exercising and following a kind of military-style discipline in support of the leadership and the objectives of the leadership. And the military, rather than the working class, for example, under a traditional Marxist interpretation, is in some ways the leading force of the revolution. And so the nuclear program and the space program, which we haven't talked about, and I take the space program as being a euphemism for the missile program, have really become very important tools of domestic legitimation for the regime. They're on billboards, they're on the news, you know, they're taught in the schools, in study circles, and so forth. These are achievements of this regime and this leadership, which I think have become important pieces of the new leader's domestic position.
This Scholar Circle panel on the politics of North Korea originally aired in April 2013. Let's turn to the U.S.'s response and the international community's response to North Korea. Jacques Hymans, let's bring you in for this first. How would you assess the U.S.'s response, the international community's response, and how would you contrast that with how you think we should be responding?
At least in this current crisis, the U.S. has reacted with a lot of probity and restraint. Of course, as Charles mentioned earlier, there are these South Korean-U.S. joint military exercises that always anger the North Koreans, and so in that sense, the U.S. can be said to have teed up the conditions for this current crisis, but with the crisis spiraling as it has, the U.S. has not added fuel to the fire. I really give the administration very high marks for how they have reacted, and this also goes for the vast majority of the states in the international community, which basically have North Korea know that they really are taking things too far and they need to cool it.
Stephen Haggard, would you agree?
I guess I'm a little bit more critical. I think it was very important to show the flag on the part of both the South Koreans and the United States that the deterrent was there. Because what we don't want is we don't want the North Koreans miscalculating and probing either along the border or particularly out at sea along what's called the northern limit line. And that's it's actually in the maritime sphere where a lot of the probes in action have taken place. So I think showing that deterrent and so forth. But I think the stationing of new interceptors in Alaska and Guam, the bombing over flights, the U.S. rhetoric on the nuclear capacity of our bomber fleet and so forth, I think it's time to kind of stand down from that. The point has been made. And I don't think we're interested in continuing to wave that stick. But let me raise one other important point we haven't discussed, and that's the role of China in this. Because China, as both Jacques and Charles well know, they've both written on this, China is really a key player because North Korea is increasingly dependent on China. The sanctions that the international community have imposed on North Korea have essentially made North Korea more, not less, dependent on Chinese trade and investment. And so the geopolitics of the region and how we're going to get back to negotiations if we do is going to have to go through Beijing making some strategic decisions about how much pressure it's going to place on North Korea.
Charles Armstrong, please respond to that relationship between China and North Korea and other actors that you think are important, how they're evolving and how they might play out.
I would give the Obama administration pretty low marks for their policy toward Korea in general, which has been characterized mostly by neglect rather than really paying attention to the issue. And ignoring North Korea is certainly not going to make it go away. And yes, it is important to, as Steph has said, to show the flag, to demonstrate to our allies especially, as well as to North Korea, that the U.S. will stand up to provocation. But it also brings about the danger of adding fuel to the fire. When the U.S. does bring in nuclear submarines, advanced fighters, and go on bombing dummy raids and so forth, it elicits a predictable response of North Korea, raising the stakes and ratcheting up the rhetoric and actions even higher. So we do have to think about a way out of this and to seriously consider how we will resolve this issue short of a military confrontation. And this brings us to negotiation, which of course also brings us to China. I don't know if the six-party talks that were suspended in 2009 are the way to go, but there needs to be some sort of forum in which the parties directly involved in this, particularly the U.S., North and South Korea, and China, but perhaps Japan and even Russia as well, can figure out a way, sit down and talk with each other to prevent this sort of thing from happening, and not merely to contain North Korea, but to allow it a way to enter into a region in a more productive manner. China is in an interesting position. It has signed on to the sanctions. It's talked tougher than it has in the past, but it's not clear that they're much more willing to do anything more than they had before to enforce sanctions. They still are not willing to risk destabilization of their neighbor, and they don't want to push North Korea too far. At the end of the day, the Chinese say, and I think there's some truth to it, they cannot tell the North Koreans what to do. North Koreans are tough customers and have always been so, even at the peak of their alliance with China. So we have to find, as difficult as it is to imagine now, a way to negotiate a solution to this problem that involves North Korea, China, and South Korea at a minimum.
And in terms of the sanctions, do you think we should change our policy with that?
The sanctions are there. The lifting of sanctions should be an incentive to North Korea if it does certain things and moves in a direction that is beneficial to others around it. But ultimately, there has to be, as much as I hate to use this expression, carrots as well as sticks.
Right. An age-old expression that still kind of works. Let me just do a quick check if anybody feels they have something they must say. Jacques Hymans?
Just briefly, it seems to me that the test of the American, the kind of correctness or the success of the American policy is precisely whether or not this situation in North Korea is bringing us closer with China or farther away from China. And it seems to me quite clear that the North Korean actions and the American response, which I view as measured and correct, have been bringing China and America closer together rather than driving them apart as the North Koreans would prefer. So that's one of the main reasons why I view the American response as having really been proper.
Stephen Haggard?
I think there are two dilemmas of U.S. policy, and they can be stated fairly briefly. One is that we simultaneously have to send signals of deterrence at the same time that we're leaving a door open for negotiations. And those two policies are kind of in contradiction from the North Korean perspective, because they see sanctions, they see deterrence, and at the same time, we have sent signals of a willingness to negotiate. And second, we have to leave the door open to negotiations, even though it's becoming increasingly clear, to me at least, that the North Koreans actually have very little interest in negotiating. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Obama administration has not invested a lot of resources in North Korea, because there's just not much return to be had from doing so.
We'll leave it there then. Thank you, Charles Armstrong, Stephen Haggard, Jacques Hymans. Great to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Stephen Haggard is professor at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. He's a co-author of Famine in North Korea. He also co-edits a blog about North Korea. Jacques Hymans is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of The Psychology of Nuclear Proliferation, Identity, Emotions, and Foreign Policy. Charles Armstrong is professor of Korean studies and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The Koreas and the forthcoming Tyranny of the Week, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.